Next, I'd like to introduce John Leslie. He received his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from the University of California, Berkeley in 1949, and master's degrees in mechanical engineering and electrical engineering from Stanford in 1963 and 1965, respectively. He taught at the Radio Materiel School for the Navy from 1942 to 46, and became a subcontractor for Ampex in 1948. By 1950, he joined Ampex officially, where he worked in a wide variety of positions until 1962, including as an engineer, chief engineer of the Professional Products Division, executive vice president and general manager of Oradio, vice president and general manager of Ampex Magnetic Tape Division, and as vice president and general manager of the Ampex Military Products Division. He taught mechanical engineering as a teaching assistant and then as an associate professor at Stanford from 1962 to 65. Following this, he was the manager of engineering of the Mountain View Division of Hewlett-Packard from 1966 to 69, moving to the Pemtec Corporation from 1970 to 75, where he was the vice president of engineering. To cap his career, he's president and general manager of the Analytic Instruments Division of United Scientific Corporation from 1976 to 80, and continued as vice president from 1981 to 84 when United Scientific was acquired by Tracker X-Ray. And so again, with great pleasure, I'd like to introduce John Leslie, who will talk about the history of the Ampex Corporation.
Thank you, Jim. This is high tech down here. It's interesting this morning trying to get these computers connected to this system. It turned out to be next to impossible. I wonder if there's an engineer in the crowd. Thank you, Jerry, for introducing me, and thank you, Pam, for getting this whole thing set up. As it turns out, we've had to use the Stanford laptop because mine wouldn't work. Both XPs, mine wouldn't work, and so we gave up and used the Stanford one. Well, you know, when Jerry called and asked me to give this paper, I was very surprised because, honestly, I didn't think anyone would be the least bit interested in what Ampex did some 60 years ago. I just found that very difficult. I thought by now the majority of work, recording work, was being done digitally using computers and CDs and DVDs and who would be talking about old analog recorders. I thought shortly after I agreed to give the paper, I received another surprise, and a big one. I learned that the Recording Academy was planning to give Ampex a Grammy at the February 8th, 2008 Special Awards Ceremony in Los Angeles. Now, that was only last month. And so I must say that I was very, very happy to be there. Cut the lights, please, Pam? How do you cut the lights? Good. Like magic. This is the award being given to us in Los Angeles at the Grammy Award Ceremony. And the presenter is holding the Grammy in his hand and about to give it to Gordon Strickland, who's next to him in the light-colored jacket, and he is the current director and CEO of Ampex Data Systems. Next to him is the tall one. That's the Jay McKnight, who is going to be your next speaker. And the short one is Myron Stolaroff, who is the first engineer ever hired by Ampex. And I'll be talking a lot about him shortly. And the guy over in your far right is me. The awards committee concluded And I'm reading this now. The Warrants Committee concluded the original reel-to-reel tape machines are still considered the gold standard among analog recording devices. They referenced the Model 200A, which was used for magnetic tape delay for Bing Crosby. They talked about multi-track recorders. They talked about the sound-on-sound recorders for Les Paul and the videotape recorders, of course, that revolutionized the television broadcasting. And these are just part of the reasons they gave for presenting the Ampex Merit Award. Now, part of what I'm going to be presenting obviously overlaps, and you'll see a dovetailing with what Henry presented and what I presented. You can't talk about Ampex about talking about it, say, Alex Poniatoff. It's impossible to do it. And you can't talk about it unless you talk about the 200A. You can't talk about it unless you talk about the videotape recorder. So there is going to be some overlap, but I think it'll help fill in the whole picture. I really do find it difficult to talk about Ampex without talking about Alex. He was the founder of the company, and his first three letters of Ampex obviously is AMP, his initials, and he always said that he put the EX after that because of excellence. And I must say that excellence set the standard for Ampex. Alex was the founder of the company, as I mentioned earlier, but he was also a major stabilizing force for the company through both the good times and the not so good times of those early years. He was an excellent listener and was always interested in looking for something new on the forefront of technology. And that was true right to the end of his life. He was an engineer and was a role model for all of us in those early days. And we not only respected him, we liked him, and we truly enjoyed working with him. And I say working with him, not for him. Alex was born in Russia in 1892, and he emigrated to the United States in 1927. He worked for General Electric and Pacific Gas and Electric, and also Dalmo Victor. Alex was an expert on motors and generators, and helped Dalmo Victor develop a line of motors and generators for use primarily by our military during World War II. Alex and one of the owners of Dalmo Victor, a person by the name of Tim Mosley, thought it best to manufacture those motors and generators outside the mainstream of Dalmo Victor. So they set up a company short distance away in 1944 called Ampex Electric and Manufacturing Company, where each owned 50% of that company. It was located in San Carlos and only about a block away from Dalmo Victor, so it solved their problem very nicely. Incidentally, the name of that company was shortened to Ampex Electric Corporation in 1946 and to Ampex, just plain Ampex Corporation, in 1953. The little company did quite well until the war ended and the orders started drying up, and so Alex knew he had to develop some new motors in a hurry in order to keep his little company alive. He was fortunate to hire a top-notch electrical engineer, a recent Stanford graduate who had a master's degree and was a specialist on motors and generators. And that person was just teamed up with Alex, so they had two engineers, that's all. And Tim Mosley was a silent partner, so we'll talk about him briefly a little later. The engineering team of Poniatoff and Stolaroff helped extend the life of Ampex, but the main thing they did is give them some breathing space to think of what the new direction of the company had to be. Alex decided to set up a task force to brainstorm what products might they develop and manufacture and sell. He and Myron were the only engineers, so they had to have somebody else. They wanted to have some more, so Alex went back to a good friend he had in Dalmo Victor, a fellow by the name of Harold Lindsay, and said, "Harold, will you join And you're not going to get paid, but will you join the task force? And so Harold joined, and also suggested a fourth member, and that was Walter Selsted, an electrical engineer with an electronics background. And Walt was an excellent addition, and also non-paid. As you might expect, the task force zeroed in rather quickly on some kind of product in the audio field. We were all interested in audio in those days, and so they were looking at loudspeakers and amplifiers and turntables and pickups, and they didn't quite make their mind, but they were very fortunate that they didn't have long to wait, because on May 16th, 1946, and Henry mentioned that, that's when Jack Mullen of Palmer Films in San Francisco gave a demonstration of the Institute of Radio Engineers, and showed off his one of the two magnetophones that he brought back from Germany. Harold Lindsay and Myron Stolaroff were there. Harold Lindsay and Walt Selsted were there. Myron Stolaroff and Alex Poniatoff were unable to attend. Two other people who later became important to Ampex were also there, and they were Frank Leonard and John Leslie. That's me. We both were and are longtime friends of Walt Selsted, with similar educations and interests in electronics. Frank and I were aware of the work of the task force, and we knew Alex Poniatoff, knew Myron Stolaroff, so it was no surprise that we were all together. We were all there to hear the magnetophone, and when Jack hit the play button, we and everyone in that audience were overwhelmed by the wonderful sound quality. It was just absolutely amazing. It was the closest thing to a live-sounding recording that we had ever heard. I'm going to digress a bit and talk about Jack Mullen. Jack was a graduate of Santa Clara University with a degree in electrical engineering, and his specialty was electronics. He, too, was a lover of both, along with Harold Lindsay, a lover of both classical music and good sound reproduction equipment. During World War II, he was a major in the Signal Corps and stationed in England. And often he would listen during the night to broadcasts from Germany, and that was really part of his job. And he would hear unbelievably beautiful classical music, what had to be a live broadcast, and intermixed with a few of Hitler's speeches. And he couldn't believe that Germany would be putting on live programs at 3 a.m. in the morning. So the question is, how did they do it? Well, after the war, he was transferred to Paris, and he was asked to go into Germany and look into their broadcasting operation, learn more about how they did many things in broadcasting. And Jack often talked, he was a neat guy, Jack often talked about the reaching the proverbial cross, split in the road, and happening to say, do I go that way or do I go that way? And he went to the fortunate way that led him to the magnetophones. And he then knew the secret of the good sound he heard in England. To make a long story short, he received permission to bring two of those recorders back, and with ample tape, and that's how we were able to hear one of those two machines. Now back to what happened after we heard the magnetophone demonstration. Harold Lindsay and Walt Selsted could hardly wait to get with Alex Poniatoff and Myron Stolaroff and tell them what happened. Well, Alex called Jack and said he'd sure like to hear it, and Jack told him he was going to give a similar demonstration in Los Angeles a few days later. Jack and Myron went to LA and heard the demonstration, and they were just as impressed as we were in San Francisco. The task force made a unanimous decision. Immediately after that, Ampex was going into the magnetic tape recorder business. That's how it really started. Now that the decision was made, Alex hired Harold Lindsay from Dalmo Victor and had his development team of Harold and Myron. The decision was applauded by Jack Mullen, and Jack became a great friend of Ampex and really a great help. Harold and Myron were a super team. They first of all decided they would make a playback head that would interchange with the one on the magnetophone, and if the sound quality that they heard from that machine then was equal to or better than that of the German head, they were sure they could go ahead and develop the rest of the machine. Now we're talking about them developing the Model 200A. Well, they December 1946, they tried their new head on the magnetophone, and Jack Mullen, Harold, and Myron agreed that the sound was, as far as they were concerned, better than what they'd heard with the German head. Now they were really ready to go ahead and start developing that machine. Harold concentrated on the mechanical part, since he was a mechanical engineer, and with the capstan assembly drive system, the layout, and all the cabinetry, and all the mechanical details. And he was a perfectionist. Myron concentrated on the special motors that had to be developed, and he also handled the system wiring and the signal electronics. By October 1st, 1947, Myron and Harold had a prototype that closely resembled the eventual Model 200A. Jack, who is now, as Henry mentioned, chief engineer at Bing Crosby Enterprises, encouraged them to take their prototype to Los Angeles and set it up in Bing Crosby's studio at the American Broadcasting Company in Hollywood. Jack thought it would be a perfect time to demonstrate the machine to Bing because it was the first night of the 1947-48 season, and Jack could play back a portion of the program prior to airtime. The recording was made on one of the two magnetophones that Jack was using, and he was using both of them now for recording the Bing Crosby show. And so this is, of course, recorded on one of them. Jack played it on the 200A, and Bing was very impressed. Bing Crosby knew that it was imperative for him to have his shows recorded in a way that no one would be able to tell that they were not live shows. Jack had made it clear that his two magnetophones were getting mighty tired and very difficult to keep working properly. The Ampex 200A was the answer to Bing's dream. In those days, Bing had to do two live shows, or have it done on recorded on the magnetophone, two live shows, one for the Eastern time zone, another 3 hours later for the Western. Of course, it made it wonderful with using tape recording because he could record just one show and then play it on the Eastern time zone, then wait 3 hours and play it again on the Western, and so the problem was solved with only doing one performance. And that was a great advantage to Bing since he was so laid back. Bing Crosby, no pun intended. Bing, he really was he was an interesting person. He hated schedules. He just hated them. And if someone said, you have to have this done, as Jerry would probably be saying to me, this has to be done in 5 minutes, Bing ignored it. And so a time schedule is something he did not follow. He really needed tape in order to be able to get it down, squashed down to the proper time frame. Bing placed an order for 12 recorders at $4,000 each, and with advance payment. That was important. Ampex had no money. He wanted them as soon as possible. Bing's money up front helped fund Ampex's first production run of 20 recorders. Bing eventually sold most of those 12 to the American Broadcasting Company. So he ended up just with a very few. Here's a picture of the 200A. That's Alex Poniatoff on the right and Harold Lindsay on the left. Yeah. In 1948, Alex hired Frank Leonard to optimize the combination of 3M magnetic tape and the electronic equalization of the 200A recorder. Frank tested many samples. Incidentally, 3M did a wonderful, wonderful job working with us in those early days. They sent many experimental batches of tape. They too wanted to get into this business. And so Frank would test them, and so it was a very close relationship. Finally, he settled on what they called at that time their experimental tape called RR. And that was what the early machines all went out and equalized for RR tape. At that point, Ampex was ready to start production, and they had only a half dozen people. That's all they could afford. I wasn't yet on the payroll, but helped assemble the electronics. Harold Lindsay built the heads. Frank Leonard checked out the recorders, and serial numbers 1 and 2 went to Bing Crosby Enterprises, Jack Mullen could record the shows. This was a revolutionary, and then the rest of them went to Chicago, most of the rest of them, for tape delay, for the 3-hour tape delay to Eastern Zone to Western, and that was a revolutionary change, first time ever done with high quality for the radio broadcast industry. Here's another picture of this is a picture at Capitol Records of a 200A. So the 200A started being used both in broadcasting, more and more used in broadcast than in the recording industry, but they really got the recording industry started on using tape. While we were celebrating the success of the 200A, Alex Poniatoff's silent partner, Tim Mosley, decided this was time for him to sell his 50% interest in Ampex to the McMicking brothers and their Ayala group of investors. This decision gave Ampex a major boost in its ability to acquire working capital, which they needed desperately, because the McMickings had a very close tie with venture capitalists and Wall Street. They also helped Alex in the day-to-day operations by installing one of their own group and a very good person as general manager. That was Kevin Mellon, if anyone is interested in knowing. With Walt in 1949, Alex hired Walt Selsted. This was a major step for Ampex because it made it possible for Myron Stoleroff to put on a salesman's hat and explore new products and new contracts that might help support the development of those products. Myron is quick to learn that magnetic tape recording could be used for many other applications than just sound recording. With Walt Selsted on board, Alex, Harold, Myron, Frank, Walt decided that they had learned so much developing the Model 200 that they could follow with a lower price machine that would perform as well as the 200A. And we're talking now $1,500 versus $4,000, which is quite a noticeable change. Alex teamed up Walt Selsted, Harold Lindsay, and Frank Leonard developed the models 300 and 301. They were similar machines except for tape speed, with the 300 being 7.5 and 15 inches per second, and the 301 being 15 and 30 inches per second. Incidentally, the 200A was 30 inches a second. Harold and Walt developed the tape transport. Harold also came up with a new head design that was very important later, and Frank developed the new electronics and established equalization to work well with the Minnesota Mining's latest development, newest development, their Model 111 magnetic tape. Here's a picture of that 301. Now, looking at it, I cannot tell by the appearance. Well, that's a 300 or 301. The only difference is tape speed and the equalization that's in the electronics. Is you open the door, it's down, the electronics down below. The 301 turned out to be so good that it turned out to be embarrassing. It was superior to Model 200A in terms of better frequency response, better signal-to-noise ratio, lower flutter, better tape interchangeability, and all at less than half the price. Frank Leonard became so upset with the 300 being so good that he designed a modification kit for the 200 A's to make it approximate the performance of the 301. And machines with that modification, and many 200 A's were modified, machines with that modification became known as the Model 201. Soon the shipments of 300s and 301s overshadowed those of the 200A, and Ampex phased out the 200A with 113 having been shipped. Now back to Myron wearing his salesman's hat. Myron had a friend and former classmate at Stanford University who worked at White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico. Myron visited and learned the complications of using a 7-channel pen recorder and then trying to analyze the data visually. His friend asked Myron, can Ampex build a 7-channel tape recorder that has a response of 0 to a few hundred hertz? Well, he said that way he could analyze it using a computer. Myron discussed the problem with Walt Selsted, and Walt's answer was, how soon do they want it? Walt was totally convinced that this transport, this 300 transport, could be modified to use half-inch tape, and with Harold Lindsay's new head design, it lent itself to being stacked so he could put half-inch, stack them so you could put 7 tracks on a half-inch tape on that machine. And he said, then the other complication is all we need is an FM signal system, and we can go to 0 hertz. Well, with the White Sands order in the house, Alex Poniatoff called me and said, how quickly can you join us? And so in February 1950, I joined them officially. And incidentally, at that point, to show you how small the company was, I was employee number 35. And that included all the girls on the line, and that's all there was in the company. I quickly became involved with the FM system, signal system for the White Sands, and also a number of other contracts that Myron had negotiated. The business was really coming in. Ampex had to expand quickly to meet the demand, and we did a lot of hiring. And as Henry mentioned, we went to a high school student, part-time, Ray Dolby. And I'll tell you, he was a jewel from the day one. He was 17 years old when we hired him. The 1950 was really a great year for shipping recorders, and Frank Leonard and Harold Lindsay were very busy now starting to develop our next machine, which was the Model 400. This was a more compact than the 300, had very similar performance, and was less expensive. It was introduced in the late 1950 with full track and half track versions. The recorder was used mainly by recording studios because it was more easily moved from site to site. In early 1952, Frank tried the multi-track heads on it using the same stacking approach that we had used in the White Sands job. And it worked so well for stereo that he introduced then versions of the models 300 and 400 for 2-track and 3-track stereo operation. In 1953, Ampex introduced the Model 350. And here's a picture of it. This particular unit, it became the workhorse of the radio stations and other studios around the world. It really did go around the world. It superseded the 400. And this particular picture is a 2-channel machine rack mounted, and of course it had cabinet versions also. Then the same year, 53, we started developing the Model 600, and Henry showed a picture of the 600 in a single channel version, and which is, and so here you are with a 600. This is the first machine we put out with a using maximum size reels of 7-inch. And it was aimed at the portable market, of course, and with the base unit coming out at only 27 pounds, so it wasn't too bad to carry. It was our first recorder that was really in these using the tiny reels. I'm going to backtrack now a bit to 1952. And there's a slight difference between Henry's view and mine. He has a late 51, I have an early 52, but it's in that neighborhood. The question many asked us, and we asked ourselves, for a matter of fact, is can Ampex record video on magnetic tape? Honestly, we didn't know. But we said, gee, you know, it's worth a try. So we very quietly, with no fanfare, for a matter of fact, we put them into a room all to themselves. We started Charlie Ginsburg, had him be the project engineer, and teamed him with Ray Dolby, where Ray was now a student here at Stanford University, and their job was to find out, can we do it? Well, their progress was so encouraging that Ray became so excited about the project that he quit school. You can believe it, here he is with a doctor's degree. He quit school, dropped out to work full-time on the project. Unfortunately for Ampex and also for Ray, he lost his draft deferment and was drafted. We assigned additional engineers to the project, and by 1955, Charlie and his group had reached the conclusion, yes, we can do video on tape. We're going to be able to do it. We know that. It's just going to take some time. Ray Dolby returned from his two-year tour of duty just in time to develop the signal electronics. Charlie and his team of six gave a demonstration of their prototype to the Ampex board of directors in the very early part of 1956, and all were very impressed. The decision was made to take the wraps off of this secret project, and we really did keep it pretty secret, and show it to the world in April 1956 at the National Association of Radio and Television Broadcasters in Chicago. Actually, the big event for Ampex was the day before, when Bill Lodge, who is Vice President of Engineering of Columbia Broadcasting System, had scheduled a meeting for the CBS's television personnel. They were in an auditorium that was maybe 100 feet deep, 70 feet wide, and they had three monitors down that side, three down this side, so that the audience, everyone there, could get a good view of Bill Lodge when he was here at the podium up in front. And about 200 people, give or take a few, came into the room and took their seats, and not a single one of them had the slightest hint what Bill Lodge and Ampex had in store for them. Bill Lodge went to the podium, and behind him was a curtain that could be pulled, but it was closed, so you couldn't see behind the curtain. And behind that curtain, we had the Ampex videotape recorder. And at that point, it was, in those days, it was called the Mark IV. And you remember that one. And that was the forerunner of the VRX-1000 that Henry was talking about. And so the decision was made, Bill started to talk, and Fred Post of Ampex, one of the team of six, was at the controls. As Bill started to talk, Fred hit the record button. Well, recorded the whole lecture, whatever, Bill's presentation on the State of the Union and so forth about CBS. And he said, now I'll take questions. Well, that was Fred's cue to hit rewind on the videotape recorder, so he hit rewind, and so they had questions, and finally Bill said, okay, that concludes the meeting. Well, that was Fred's cue to hit play. And on those monitors, they saw exactly, as far as they were concerned, what they'd just seen previously. The quality was really remarkable. And so they were black and white monitors, so they saw it in black and white. And so they saw the same thing, heard it, saw it, and the group went wild. They just is screaming, it just is unbelievable. And as Fred Post, when he tells this story, he cannot tell the story to even today without the tears coming to his eyes. It was so spectacular.
We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Here's a picture of that machine. That's this one that was behind the curtain. Next day when the meeting, when the convention started, Ampex sold, yes, the 16 that Henry talked about, which CBS wanted. They wanted to have this machine as quickly as possible, the prototype, and they called it the VRX-1000, and they wanted that as quickly as they could get it. But in addition to that, Ampex, and incidentally, that was at $75,000 each. Ampex also sold of the new VR-1000, the production machines, 45 of them at $45,000 each. Here's a picture of the production machine, which is the same one that Henry used, and this is ready to go to shipping, and the rack behind Alex are the electronics for that particular machine. Now, compare that to what you get today. As recently as the 29th of 2005, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences gave the Emmy Award to each, now this is just 2005, Emmy Award to each of those six who were on that original team. And I want to show you a picture of the six. And now this is a little different picture than Henry showed you, and you go, this is one of the units in the lab, and you go around left to right, it's Charlie Anderson, Shelby Henderson, Alex Maxey, there's Ray Dolby, third one from the right is Ray Dolby, and then Fred Post, and on the right is Charlie Ginsburg. Note in the middle of the picture an Emmy sitting on top of that recorder. Shortly after they had given their introduction in Chicago, Ampex was awarded an Emmy, and there it is. They thought that was very appropriate to have the picture taken with that Emmy. One thing we've not talked about is magnetic tape. And in the 111 tape with 3M introduced in 1949 became the standard by which all tapes were compared for quite some time. And by 1955, Ampex had a real problem. Our recorders, our professional recorders, were performing so well quality-wise and design-wise that there was frequency response variations were much more due to the tape than due to the recorder itself. And so at that point, thought we have to do something. I've been chief engineer of the professional products division, and I went to each of the four manufacturers, 3M, Reeve Soundcraft, Audio Devices, or Radio, and told them what our problem was. They didn't think they had a problem at all. They were selling tape like crazy, and they weren't getting complaints from anybody else. Of course, the professional market was very small compared to the home market, and so they were doing quite well, and they didn't need to hear us anymore. Well, we decided at Ampex we had no choice but getting into the tape business, and so we ended up by buying 25% of Aura Radio with an option, it was in 1957, and the option to buy the remaining 75% in 1959. I moved to Opelika, Alabama, and became general manager of Aura Radio, and we did a tremendous amount to improve the product, and it really turned out to be a great advantage to Ampex and to the users of Ampex professional equipment, because we now have the ability to control both the machine and the tape. Now, by 1995, we were the tape business really became quite unprofitable, and Ampex sold their operation to Quantigy. 1 year later, 1996, 3M sold their operation, their assets, to Quantigy. So Quantigy turned out to be the remaining only manufacturer in the United States for a number of years, and they, in 2005, they started running into bankruptcy problems. They closed the door forever in just last year. I'd like to conclude by mentioning the Ampex still exists in Redwood City as Ampex Data Systems. They provide technology for acquisition, storage, and processing of visual information. They have excellent management, and they have some very fine engineers, and my hope is that they can put together a string of glory years comparable to what we did in those early years. Thank you.